Welcome to the ASHP Official Podcast, your guide to issues related to medication use, public health, and the profession of pharmacy.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Clinical Conversations from ASHP Official. This podcast includes discussions about therapeutics, best practices, emerging therapies, case studies, and other topics that the clinical pharmacist will find important in practice. My name is Paris Smith. I am an ambulatory care clinical pharmacist at Parkview Health in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I will be your host for today. With me are Jessica Beaudelahay, who is a clinical pharmacist practitioner at the Washington, D.C. VA, as well as Megan Adelman, who is a clinical pharmacy specialist at Cleveland Clinic, Akron General Family Medicine in Akron, Ohio. This is part two of a series focused on GLP-1 agonist use. We encourage you to listen to the first part of this series if you have not done so already, where we talked about long-term implications of use, drug shortages, and guideline updates. Today, our panelists are primed and ready to help you navigate through some clinical quandaries and updates on this topic. So let's get started, everyone. While many of patients are interested in using these agents for type 2 diabetes as well as obesity, we know there may be some true contraindications or concerns for use. So Jessica, can you tell us more about who may not be a candidate for these therapies?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Paris. So first, I just wanted to backtrack real quick and discuss or review the indications or two major indications for these GLP-1 receptor agonists and the GLP-GIPs, and then we'll discuss some of the contraindications. So GLP-1 agonists and GLP-GIPs are approved for type 2 diabetes and for weight loss. Our most widely used type 2 diabetes agents include semaglutide, which is Ozempic, dulaglutide, which is Trulicity, liraglutide, which is Victoza, and tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro, which is the GLP-GIP agent. Whereas guidelines used to promote metformin consistently as a first-line agent, per the ADA 2024 standards of care guidelines, GLP-1 receptor agonists can also now be considered first-line agents, in particular in patients with clinical ASCVD or with indicators of high risk of ASCVD, which includes an age of at least 55 and two or more additional risk factors, such as hypertension, obesity, smoking, dyslipidemia, and/or chronic kidney disease. So it's important to note that the cost of these agents also play a role, though, in whether or not insurance companies or health systems will also encourage use as first-line agents, particularly when other agents, such as the SGLT2 inhibitors with similar cardiovascular risk reduction benefit, and even with other agents such as TZDs and metformin, may be less cost prohibitive. It's also important to note, too, that given the current issues with medication shortages, I know we talked a lot about that in part one, that are affecting those GLP-1 agonists and the GLP-GIPs, that the health systems and prescribers really pay attention to those differences in products available and the differing costs and approved indications and the supply. So it's crucial that we continue to protect the supply for patients with type 2 diabetes who have exhausted other first-line options and need these agents to achieve or maintain their A1C goals when there's generally not enough to go around. So for example, patients without diabetes and otherwise healthy that are wanting to lose 10 pounds for a wedding coming up should probably be lower priority or not considered to receive these GLP agonists that are approved for type 2 diabetes. And for patients that are willing and able to pay out of pocket, really that opportunity to protect the supply from off-label or cosmetic use really lies with the prescribers. But let's talk about the weight loss indication for these agents. So semaglutide, liraglutide, and as of November 2023, tirzepatide are approved as Wegovy, Saxenda, and Zepbound for weight loss. So the dosing does differ a little bit for semaglutide and liraglutide for weight loss than the type 2 diabetes at higher doses. But per the Endocrine Society guidelines for management of obesity in adults, pharmacotherapy can be considered in patients with a BMI of at least 30 or at least 27 with one associated comorbid medical condition, such as hypertension, dyslipidemia, type 2 diabetes, or obstructive sleep apnea. Pharmacological management should always be in conjunction with diet, exercise, and behavioral modification to increase the chances of long-term success with pharmacological agents. So now that we've discussed the indications for therapy, let's talk a little bit more about the contraindications or some other warnings or concerns. So we know that GLP-1s have a U.S. boxed warning for thyroid C-cell tumors. GLPs and GLPGIPs are contraindicated in patients with a personal or family history of medullary thyroid cancer or multiple endocrine neoplasia type 2. Initially, GLP agonists were approved with this box warning based on animal or rat studies. But more recently, a nested case control analysis performed in the French National Healthcare Insurance System database between 2006 and 2018 concluded that they did see an increased risk of all thyroid cancer and medullary thyroid cancer with patients with the use of GLP-1s, in particular after 1 to 3 years of treatments. That said, though, other previous randomized controlled trials did not show an increased risk for thyroid cancer with different GLP-1s individually or within a meta-analysis. So there are some challenges in interpreting this mixed data that we're getting. And one of the challenges is that the overall incidence of medullary thyroid cancer is very low. It comprises about less than 5% of the global thyroid cancer burden, which makes it difficult to obtain enough statistical power in studies to detect a difference with needing a very large sample size in any prospective study. So we also know that diabetes itself has been shown to be associated with a 20 to 30% increased risk of thyroid cancer in several meta-analyses, which was unable to be adjusted for in that French study that did show a difference. So the bottom line is that we should be considering thyroid cancer as a potential risk with these agents and monitoring appropriately. Reporting any incidence of thyroid cancer in patients on a GLP or GLP-GIP to the FDA to ensure continued pharmacovigilance on this subject. While a history of medullary thyroid cancer or MEN2 should still be considered a contraindication given the potential risks with an established history, there's really not enough evidence at this time to completely avoid these agents in other patients without that additional risk, solely on that, given all the other potential benefits we've been talking about with the GLPs. Another new concern that we mentioned in part one briefly is that FDA safety alert published in January of 2023 regarding psychiatric effects and in particular suicidal ideation or attempts with GLP-1s. Importantly, the FDA in the alert states that their preliminary evaluation has not found any evidence of increased incidence of suicidal thoughts or actions in patients at this time. The FDA is continuing to look into the issue and reports from the FDA Adverse Event Reporting System. Again, this subject is difficult to study as there are multiple variables at play, including the relationship between obesity, diabetes, and mental health conditions, such as depression and anxiety. Now, we do know that these agents cross the blood-brain barrier, and in fact, there have been some interesting studies published on GLPs and neurogenesis. But to date, again, we do not have enough evidence to say there is a direct link between GLPs and suicidal thoughts or behaviors. But it is important to report any suspected adverse drug reaction and continue counseling patients on the potential risks. There's also a lot of publicity lately about growing concerns with GLPs and GLP-GIPs and the risk for bowel obstruction and gastroparesis. So given that these agents work in slowing gastric motility and emptying, we do see higher risk for side effects like nausea, vomiting, constipation. So if they slow down motility, can they also increase risk for obstruction? Well, the jury seems to still be out on that one as well. And a large real-world study published in 2022 in the Clinical Pharmacology and Therapeutics Journal, authors concluded that GLPs and DPP-4 inhibitors were associated with an increased risk of intestinal obstruction, with a number needed to harm for GLPs after 1 year of use of over 1,000 and 603 with DPP-4 inhibitors. And this trial was done in comparison with people on SGLT2 inhibitors. Another study that was published in the Clinical Gastroenterology and Hepatology in 2023, however, were not able to confirm this increased risk using data from Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, again using SGLT2 inhibitors as a comparator. So hopefully more pharmacovigilance and study can shed more light on the issue of bowel obstruction in GLPs And similarly, the relationship between gastroparesis and GLPs are still unclear. We know that diabetes alone does increase the risk for gastroparesis, and that agents that slow gastric motility can predispose these patients to a higher risk for adverse reactions. So again, that pharmacovigilance and making sure that we're reporting things when they happen and screening patients with diabetes for gastroparesis. A history of pancreatitis or other risk factors besides diabetes for pancreatitis, such as severe hypertriglyceridemia, excessive alcohol use, is something to also be cautious about when starting GLPs. Current literature supports there may be an increased risk for pancreatitis with GLP-1 agonists and DPP-4 inhibitors. Given the potential severity of pancreatitis, it is important to educate patients on the signs and symptoms of pancreatitis and control for the other risk factors like alcohol consumption and triglycerides whenever possible. And the final consideration to discuss today is diabetic retinopathy. So in phase 3 trials, semaglutide showed a statistically significant increase in worsening of diabetic retinopathy. Dulaglutide and liraglutide did not show the statistically significant difference, although dulaglutide did show a trend toward worsening. So the controversy surrounding the risk for diabetic retinopathy with GLPs is that we also know that rapid change in A1C can increase the risk for retinopathy. So is it something intrinsic to the medication or an indirect effect due to rapid change in glucose levels? It's kind of hard to say. Most of our retinopathy data is coming from those phase 3 or cardiovascular outcomes trials of these agents, and those were not designed or powered to assess retinopathy outcomes. So I think it's important to keep in mind that progression of retinopathy because of intensified diabetes control tends to be transient and reversible, whereas poor diabetes control over time is a known cause of retinopathy and progression of retinopathy. In addition, overall, even with that potential shorter-term risk of worsening of retinopathy, overall, more intensive glycemic treatment has been shown to reduce risk of retinopathy over time, even compared with conventional treatment. Therefore, it's reasonable to start these agents in patients with mild to moderate, non-proliferative retinopathy and assess the risks and benefits with the patients and to consult eye specialists to monitor more closely, especially if these agents are being considered in patients with non-proliferative and severe retinopathy or proliferative diabetic retinopathy.
Wow, Jessica, you gave us some great information, a lot of not only applicable to pharmacists, but really all providers as we start to see these medications significantly skyrocket in terms of requests from patients, provider questions. So lots to think about. I certainly think that we're going to hopefully get some more and more information as time goes on too, but you brought up some excellent points. I'm going to pivot a little bit in terms of maybe some other clinical considerations that we think about. Frequently as a pharmacist in family medicine, I'm getting questions about drug-drug interactions, the different alerts that come on to Epic. Paris, can you talk to us? I know there's some interesting dialogue about tirzepatide use and a drug-drug interaction with oral contraception specifically, which we don't see in the package inserts with the other. This is tirzepatide, GLP-1, GIP, but the other GLP-1s, we don't see this alert for a drug-drug interaction. Can you talk more about it and what should pharmacists be telling patients?
Of course. Thanks for the question, Megan. And it's so funny because this actually came up when I was prescribing Mounjaro for one of my younger patients who is on an oral contraceptive. When I went to prescribe it in Epic, it got a pop-up alert that says there's an interaction. So I had to look into, wait, what is this interaction? I don't see this normally with my prescribed dulaglutide or semaglutide. So what makes tirzepatide so different? So let's backtrack a little bit. And I want to talk about kind of where this started coming from. So there is a study in the tirzepatide package insert that showed when they combined tirzepatide with an oral contraceptive that tirzepatide had lowered the maximum serum concentration, the area under the curve of the concentration, and the time to maximum plasma concentration of specifically ethinyl estradiol and norgestimate by a clinically significant amount, which makes that oral contraceptive not as effective as the patient would hope to be. And it's really thought to be due to tirzepatide's mechanism of action, where it delays gastric emptying, which we know is beneficial for weight loss and diabetes patients, it's just not really great with the absorption of oral contraception. So when I dug into a little bit more, I had a conversation with my patient about this, and I talked to her about two different options that we can talk with patients about and have these discussions before prescribing Mounjaro. So I discussed with her that if you would like to stay on oral contraception as we've been working for you, we would have to use a backup method for her for 4 weeks after initiation of Mounjaro and for 4 weeks after each dose escalation. Now, when you think about it, tirzepatide has six doses, 2.5, 5, 7.5, 10, 12.5, and 15, and the goal is to titrate them up to the max tolerable dose. Now, if you get a patient up to the 15 milligrams, that is, and you do it every 4 to 6 weeks, that's at minimum 24 weeks of dose escalation and titration. And those patients would have to be on a backup method for 4 weeks after you start the 2.5 and then 4 weeks after each dose escalation. So that's essentially as well of them using 24 weeks of a backup method, which may not be feasible for them as well. So if the patient does not want to continue on an oral contraceptive, we can have conversations as well about potentially switching to a non-oral contraceptive method. Presently, we do have hormonal contraception that's not in a pill form, such as an IUD, a vaginal ring, Depo-Provera shot, the patch as well, or an Implanon or Nexplanon. All of which should be discussion with the patient, but the patient should also be having those conversations as well with their primary care provider just to make sure that they don't have any contraindications to using an alternative form of contraception. So we should be really counseling these patients about using the backup method if they're going to continue on their oral contraceptive, or having a conversation with the primary care provider and the patient about switching them to a different one. My patient decided to switch to the Nexplanon because honestly, it was actually a little bit easier for her. And then after we did that and it was settled in, we ended up starting her on Mounjaro. She's been doing well with that. But Megan, you brought up a good point that the package inserts for semaglutide, dulaglutide, and liraglutide don't have these contraindications or drug interactions with the oral contraceptive. However, for exenatide, specifically the Byetta formulation, it's recommended to take the oral contraception 1 hour prior to using Byetta. So if you do have a patient on Byetta and hormonal oral contraceptive, just making sure that they are timing both of those medications accordingly as well.
I think definitely great points. It's interesting. I similarly had an individual that we started her on tirzepatide Mounjaro. And she actually opted for an IUD. And I think that this is it very as much as reminiscent to me, different mechanism, but reminiscent of your oral contraceptives interaction with something like topiramate or your anti-seizures. Certainly, you're looking at a relatively maybe low risk, but I'm not a gambling woman. And that's what I usually tell to my individuals that, you know, you're looking at maybe one or two unplanned pregnancies per a couple 100. But if you're one or two of that, that's not a gambling position. So again, I think presenting those risks and benefits to the patient is incredibly helpful and a great avenue for really pharmacists in any setting. As we're talking about tirzepatide, I was actually going to run into, we had some really exciting news that in December of 2023, that tirzepatide, similar to our semaglutide, first FDA approved under the brand name of Ozempic, and then similarly later approved for weight management or anti-obesity under the brand name of Wegovy, tirzepatide followed suit. So we have our first initial approval under brand name of Mounjaro for diabetes, and then in December of 2023, newly approved for anti-obesity or weight management under Zepbound. A couple of different things to think about. So the dosing is actually the exact same. You have a stepwise approach, 2.5, 5, 7.5, 10, 12.5, and 15 at 4 week intervals where you increase. Similarly, with all of our GLP-1 agonists, with the GLP-1 GIP, the GI side effects tend to be the most common thing that I see patients describe. This is not only dose related, but tends to be transient in nature if people get used to it. So sometimes I do extend those stepwise approaches as I'm increasing the dose, both for tirzepatide as Mounjaro, but tirzepatide as Zepbound as well. The SURMOUNT-1 trial, which we'll link for this, was published in New England Journal of Medicine, demonstrated phenomenal weight loss. This is really something, as somebody that practices in the weight management arena, I got super excited about, because this weight loss is almost what you would parallel in terms of a gastric sleeve, not to that full extent at a year, but pretty comparable. 15% with the lower doses, 22% with the higher doses. And what did that look like? Again, just pretty significant. Patients lost anywhere between 30, 40 plus pounds. So definitely as compared to our other ones, the highest weight loss to date. Downside, in addition to the GI complications, really is the cost. Right now, it is being marketed as a less expensive alternative to its competitor, semaglutide Wegovy. Cash price for that agent is around $1,400. Cash price for our tirzepatide Zepbound is around $1,100. It's interesting, in my area, I'm actually seeing a mix. I've had a couple of individuals who, surprisingly, their insurance, it's a commercial pay, already covered this. There is a coupon that you can add that brings it down to $25 if insurance covers it. If insurance does not cover it, the patients can pay a reduced cost at $550. I've not had anybody take that offer up. But interestingly, again, I have two patients right now that are on it that their insurance provided some coverage and then the coupon assisted. I don't know, Jessica Paris, have you guys seen this utilized yet?
I definitely use the copay cards for sure for my commercial patients. It's definitely been very helpful. I practice in Indiana, so my Medicaid plan covers, you know, semaglutide and then dulaglutide, so I'll often have to do a prior auth for tirzepatide, but the patients that I do have on it love it. And they are actually doing really well. I've even had patients, you know, fail dulaglutide, semaglutide, but do well with tirzepatide, which on paper, as we know, tirzepatide has that extra GIP. So on paper, that should not, you know, necessarily make sense, but it's working and it's definitely helping with the weight loss and the blood sugars as well, and really helping them potentially de-escalate on other therapies as well too.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm just super excited. I'm seeing great results from this. So I'm not even at the higher doses yet for weight loss, but the studies just don't lie. I mean, you look at the STEP trial with semaglutide, SURMOUNT-1 with tirzepatide, and it's a no-brainer from the weight loss perspective, at least. So I'm anxiously, I guess, more to come on the novel therapies, but this is, I think, just a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and here at the VA for us, of course, we don't have the same issues with insurance coverage, but in our closed health group system at the VA, we do have tirzepatide and Zepbound available. And in fact, we just had a huge surge in use of it because of the Wegovy shortages. So right now, we're not even approving people for new starts of Wegovy just because we're unable to get the product. So now that Zepbound has become available, we've seen a huge surge in starting people on Zepbound for weight loss. And I myself have started quite a few patients. So we're still on the lower doses. So it will be interesting to see over time how it does in comparison.
I honestly think we're just really getting started with all of these new agents. And I am excited to see what we have now and the things that we see for our, not only for patients for diabetes, but for obesity as well. And I am looking forward to the next few years to see what else comes out of this class. Do we add new more agents? Do we see new studies about new potential side effects or new potential mechanisms? I think it's really an exciting time to be in AmCare for sure, especially in family medicine. And I honestly think we're only just getting started. But thank you, Megan and Jessica, for joining us today's episode of Clinical Conversations. If you haven't before, I encourage you all to check out ASHP's ambulatory care resources. You can find member exclusive offerings such as the ambulatory care career tool, certification resources, rotation guides, guidelines, policies, and info on billing and reimbursement. Be sure also to become a member of the Section of Ambulatory Care Practitioners Connect community, where you can exchange ideas and ask questions from your peers. Thanks again for tuning in for this episode, and be sure to subscribe to the ASHP podcast through your favorite podcast provider.
Thank you for listening to ASHP Official, the voice of pharmacists advancing healthcare. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time on ASHP Official.